This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Steve Marsh is with us. He's chairman and founder of Smarsh and joining us here on site. First of all, compliance is a big issue, and it has been growing, I think, coming off the great financial crisis. And I think it's interesting to hear how people are talking about it in regards to AI. But first of all, take a step back 20 years ago when you started your company and kind of where we were.
Sure. So it was probably 2001, I think, when I first started Smarsh. And
So 23 years.
Well, yeah.
And then some.
Yeah, the time flies. But yeah, really, I was doing some consulting for financial services firms and had a few of them all around the same time asked me to help them comply with what were then relatively new rules and requirements, forcing them to capture their email. So it was really just email that was a problem, and most organizations just needed to find a way to retain it so that the compliance departments could produce it when a regular came asking for it. And I helped a few of them do it and eventually found that there was a bigger and bigger business opportunity, and that's how it all started.
What was the way that you were able to do it back then that other people weren't doing? What was the value add that you brought that the industry wasn't seeing yet?
I think the biggest value add was that I had come from the financial services industry, and a lot of my competitors at the time, and there were quite a few, were really web hosting companies or internet service providers that thought they would just get into the email retention space and sell an additional product. We were very different from day one, only focusing on broker-dealers and investment advisors and really understanding the regulatory requirements that they had to comply with. Mm. And that gave a lot of the companies that we worked with much more comfort that when a regulator came knocking on their door, we would understand exactly what needed to be done, the steps needed to be taken, the proof of the steps that we're taking or that were taken in helping them retain their compliance.
It's interesting, Steve, if you think about it, right? Like in terms of where communications were 23 years ago and how they have evolved, we communicate and then, you know, layer on the pandemic on top of it. Things have gotten much more complicated. How has that changed your business and what you guys do?
Early on, you know, as you alluded to, it was really just email that companies needed to deal with. And then eventually it was AOL Instant Messenger and, and of course, Bloomberg's messaging protocols as well. So, you know, over the last two decades, that list of relatively few communication channels has exploded to now include well over 100, 150 different types of communication. And some of the largest organizations that we serve will have, you know, dozens, 50, 100 different types of communication use. So that has created a lot of opportunity for us to develop new products and new solutions to help our customers, but it also creates a lot of challenges for those that have to work with them.
I always think about in COVID, right, we were talking about, you know, in terms of spreading the virus, like the touch points. And I just think about in terms of the financial community, the touch points, as information is shared and moved around, they have increased. And that means greater risk, potentially.
Absolutely. I mean, you have to look at all those different endpoints. You may follow a conversation that starts on text message and then moves to email and then is picked up later on WhatsApp or some other communication channel. If you don't have a good sense of what's happening in your organization, you're not going to be able to follow the entire conversation. It's not single threaded anymore. It's not just taking place in one venue.
Okay, so a big issue with the SEC has been so-called disappearing message services. How do you guys deal with that?
Well, there are certain ones that were designed specifically not to be captured and retained. There are others that, we can help with from a technology standpoint. If something is specifically designed not to be viewed and monitored, I think that's where policy comes in for most organizations.
Right.
But wherever possible, we develop different mechanisms of capturing the messages so that they can be stored in the archive.
What if you're working with an organization where, okay, yes, my work accounts are ones that can be captured, but a lot of my communication happens over my personal devices or my personal services. How does that work?
Again, it's kind of nuanced and depends on the communication channel. Some of the early social networks introduced that very problem, where with Facebook, for example, you only had a personal profile, and if you were also using it for work, well, that meant that the organization had to effectively retain your personal communications, and you had to authorize them or acknowledge that you were going to use something like Facebook for personal and business communications, and you'd give the firm basically the ability to capture them.
One of the things I love about that we kind of try and do at Bloomberg, and I think we do it pretty well, is just kind of open windows into worlds that maybe people don't know about, but is just such a big part of our world. And we did it today with an earlier story, had to do with drones and so on and so forth. But I think about this is such a part of the financial world, and in kind of reading in, Tim and I, I think 19 of the world's largest 20 banks are your clients. Like, this is something that every financial institution is involved in a big way and has to be.
Absolutely.
In terms of what you do and the services you provide.
Yeah, it's not always the most well-known service, among the public, but
right.
Every broker-dealer, investment advisor, bank, hedge fund, really has some regulations they need to comply with, and we're there often behind the scenes as one of their most critical partners.
Is it getting more complicated? And I think about with financial disruption, and I think about, kind of what we've seen in cryptocurrency and the financial industry, it's just like more and more things are being thrown at them in different ways. And I always think about, is the regulatory oversight and the systems in place to kind of keep up with it?
It definitely gets more and more challenging. And I think, over the past two decades, it's gotten to the point where the compliance function is probably one of the most sophisticated within a financial services organization. I certainly don't envy some of the professionals that have to deal with other aspects of compliance, that Smarsh doesn't even, really touch or play in. So it's a challenging job, and it's a significant area of focus for the financial industry.
One thing that's so interesting about what you do is you have so many different clients, you have so many touch points on the economy. And one thing that I'm interested in is, here we are in 2024, where it's sort of like if we were doing this a year ago, the question would be, okay, when's the recession? But the economy, it seems like, is firing on all cylinders right now. What are you hearing? And certainly that's what the economic data is indicating to us. What are you hearing from your customers right now when you're talking to them about different products, different services, when it comes to how they're doing?
In terms of how they're doing?
Yeah, how they're doing.
Well, because you wonder, do they pick and choose and say, compliance they have to do, but do they pick and choose a little bit because they're a little bit worried about the outcome, or do you never see that?
Most of the conversations we have are more specifically related to their compliance and technology challenges, the types of communication tools they're using. Maybe we'll see a little bit in terms of how they're expanding or contracting the organization,
mm-hmm.
but
right.
not even really, we don't always have a great sense of that either. As far as their views on the economy and what's happening globally, and we don't get too much of that, it's more focused on compliance.
Does crypto come up? How much has crypto come into your world as well?
It does. And I think there was quite a bit of buzz about it, especially a year and a half, 2 years ago, about how crypto was going to be regulated. And really for us, what is Smarsh's role? What are our clients' role in that? I would say it's not the biggest issue, but it's still in the background. There's a lot more discussion today about artificial intelligence and how it should be regulated and how it can be used to help with communication, monitoring and surveillance.
We're going to have a bunch of conversations about that. How are you guys preparing for it? I know we're going to have some future conversations that are going to dig a little bit deeper into it, but how are you guys getting ready for it, or how have you been planning around it? What are your clients saying? Hey, Steve, are you working on this?
Yeah, we've had an aspect of artificial intelligence as part of our services for many years. And really it's to address the reality that the data volumes just are growing constantly. So, our customers are faced with a challenge where they have to sift through not only a growing number of communication channels, but the number of messages that are sent, within each of those has grown exponentially.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to be that human beings could inspect and look at the messages that would get flagged for some sort of potential compliance violation. Now it's becoming increasingly difficult. So the use of artificial intelligence helps them manage that workload. So that's probably the biggest use case and the biggest area that we hear about. But there's also certainly a discussion about how firms need to think about their own use of artificial intelligence and if that if that becomes a communication itself that needs to be archived and monitored, or if they have you know, a bot on their website that's communicating with investors, you know, how does that fit into the compliance obligations?
God, I didn't
that they
even think about that, like monitoring the bot, right?
Yeah.
Like it's got to be part of it.
Yeah.
Who monitors the bot that's monitoring the bot? That's the question.
Another bot.
Yeah, okay, there we go. So what about when it comes to the AI? Are you deploying the AI, or is the AI being deployed by these companies internally?
For the surveillance and monitoring? We help the customers deploy that, but it's with their own their own input in terms of what they want to look for and what they're trying to use it for.
Have you had to make specific hires around that type of technology that in this environment?
Many. Yes.
So how is that? Because I mean, it's like a serious talent war going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've been very fortunate that our use case is interesting. I think to the professionals that get to work at, you know, on artificial intelligence. We've got very large data stores. You know, high significance use cases to get people excited. So it's always been relatively easy to find high quality tech talent at Smart, just because, you know, we've got high security use cases, big data, always on the cutting edge of the communication tools that people want to use.
So they want to be a part of it.
Yeah.
I'm just thinking about the Bloomberg audience, investing audience, just people who want to know on trends and waves. Just got about a minute or 45, 50 seconds left here. What do you think they need to know about kind of the world that you're seeing and Smarsh Connect, like the leaders that are here, whether it's AI, compliance, technology, what do you think they need to be aware of?
I think they need to be aware that we are working as hard as we can every single day to make sure that our clients can continue to use the communication tools that they want to, which in essence is really just allowing investors to use the communication tools they want to use when they engage with their financial professional. It's sounds like a relatively simple, you know, order, but
yeah.
it's a big ask, because there are so many different ways that people want to communicate, and everybody has their own unique preferences. We're out there working with you know, our partners and our employees to try to make that all possible.
Well, we talk about transparency, right? Or making sure that financial systems are fluid and they work really well. Like, this is a part of it, right? It's kind of a cog in the wheel, if you will, in terms of doing so. Thanks so much. Thanks for inviting us here.
Really
cool
stuff.
Thanks for having me, and I'm glad you could join us.
Yeah, it's really fun to be here. We would like to be outside, though. It's really beautiful. Can we work
next
on
year?
That?
Next year, do it outside. We'll do it outside.
Just kidding. Steve Smarsh, of course. He's founder and chairman of Smarsh. We are here at Smarsh Connect in Midtown Manhattan. I'm Carol Masser, along with Tim Stanovic, live here on Bloomberg Business Week. Conversations are continuing. We're going to talk more about digital transformation and the role of all of it in compliance and managing risk for firms. We're coming back right here on Bloomberg Business Week.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Well, what do Capital One, Bank Leumi, the London Stock Exchange Group, Nomura, MasterCard, and HSBC all have in common? Well, they're all financial services firms that use Amazon Web Services, also known as AWS. Our next guest knows that because he leads the worldwide business and market development efforts for financial services at AWS, having also been an executive director at JPMorgan Chase, also working at NASDAQ, Bear Stearns, and Citi. John Kane is head of financial services and market development at AWS, and he joins us on location here at Smarsh Connect. John, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Hey, how's business right now?
It's pretty good. It's hard to imagine we're actually in the second decade of cloud adoption in financial services. And some of the things when I joined AWS 7 years ago that we wouldn't have thought were possible at all to kind of run in the cloud from a financial services infrastructure perspective are almost becoming sort of everyday stories.
Did you not think it was possible because of regulatory issues?
That was one of the big concerns. When we had those initial conversations from customers early in the day, it's like, how would our regulators think about cloud, about security, what about compliance and resilience? And over the course of the last decade, you've seen some of the most important systems actually move and run on the cloud. It was 2 years ago that NASDAQ moved its matching engine onto AWS technology, runs MRX, their options exchange. Last year, the SEC gave a no objection letter to the Options Clearing Corporation to move their risk and settlement systems to the cloud. And those are the type of crown jewels in the industry that you are always aspire to run. And I think that was a twinkle in our eyes when we started on the financial services side at AWS. And now it's sort of the reality of what we're bringing to the industry.
I mean, safe to say, John, when we break down like Amazon earnings, we talk about AWS, it's like streaming, right? And we're talking about the cloud. And I think so much of general consumers, that's what they think about. How much of what you do in the cloud is financial services based?
Well, for me, it's 100%.
For you, okay,
right.
Yeah.
But for AWS, it's a large chunk of our business. We don't break down the individual segment, but financial services is just one of the largest consumers of technology, as
and
you can
growing.
Imagine. Of course. And just because so much of what they do is just moving ones and zeros and data around, almost everything is dependent on technology. And when we look at where our customers are focused, it's bringing more personalized experience with less friction and bringing down the kind of costs across the industry.
I just want to jump in with a red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal. It has to do with Boeing. The Boeing whistleblower is set to testify at an April 17th Senate hearing. That Boeing hearing has been confirmed by a spokesperson for Senator Blumenthal. Checking in on shares of Boeing right now in the after hours. Shares of Boeing right now moving, well, really unchanged as we speak, but did fall about 1% today.
Right. We had some news earlier today in terms of Boeing deliveries. Getting back there.
1.89% today, excuse me.
All right. Good to know. John Kane, we're talking with Head of Financial Services Market Development over at AWS. What are like some of the top priorities that clients come to you and say, here's what we need to make sure that, you know, we're going to play with you in your cloud, in the Amazon cloud or AWS, and just what is top of mind for them in terms of security and risk and compliance?
So I think that's the secondary concern. If we think about sort of why firms adopt cloud, first it's to change the business dynamic, right? It moves them from having to make 3 and 5 year capital investments to being able to buy what they need when they need it and only pay for it. And when you think about like a dynamic—
So versus on-premise enterprise.
Exactly. Yeah. And when you think about something like mortgage refinancing, right? Being able to tie your business costs to the volume of business you do as opposed to an investment you made 3 years ago, it allows you to be more dynamic from a product and services perspective, right? So it changes the way you think about your business. But security and operational resilience are table stakes for us to be successful in the industry.
Right.
Our primary focus, above all else, is making sure our customers are secure and their data secure, and that our systems are running as close to perfect as possibly can be.
But it also means that you guys are taking on that CapEx risk.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the benefits, though, kind of being at our scale and our approach to the business is the larger you are, the more you have that ability to kind of work demands across industry segments and they offset each other. And if you're very much thinking about it from a financial services perspective, it's a little bit like what a clearinghouse or a clearing broker brings to the table. If they have some customers are long position, some customers short, they can manage that risk better than any one participant can. And from a technology perspective, we take advantage of that kind of scale to be able to do the same thing on behalf of our customers.
Is Gen AI, generative AI, changing any of that? Because, you know, we've been having discussions kind of back in our newsroom about the on-premise enterprise and whether or not there are going to be companies, whether it's financial or otherwise, that are going to do kind of a hybrid approach and want to have some facilities on site that maybe there is some data information or processing that they want to keep kind of closer to home versus tapping the cloud. And I'm curious how that is impacting your discussions you guys are having around that.
Yeah, I think of it in a different way. So almost all our customers start on premises and we have to work with them from a hybrid perspective to help them take advantage of the cloud. And we want to make that infrastructure look as transparent to their existing infrastructure as possible. I think Gen AI, though, accelerates the move to the cloud as opposed to kind of keeps it on-prem. When you think about the sheer computing power necessary to drive these foundational models, to kind of see that expertise, it's beyond the ability for most firms to be able to make that investment, right? When you think about the risk you're taking to buy that much specialized compute at scale to train essentially almost all of human knowledge to kind of build one of these models, you can't take that risk on as an individual enterprise. You've got to figure out how to leverage kind of best of breed providers. And we have the ability to kind of invest enough in our infrastructure to specialize it so it works both at scale and at a lower price point. We even build our own silicon chips to actually make those things more efficient. So we see, especially in the generative AI space, that need to leverage the cloud to both be successful in building new foundation models, but more importantly, how most of our customers are actually going to take advantage of it. They're going to use one of the existing foundational models that are out there from an Anthropic or kind of a Meta or Cohere, and want to use it themselves. And we want to make that available, and we want it so they can use it right away, right? So they're not going, hey, how do I build out a technology plan? How do I finance this with my CFO? It's like, oh, great, we can go try this, right? And we make that immediately available. And we think that just accelerates the value of AWS.
So you're not seeing really any kind of shift in terms of people wanting to have it more on-premise?
No, actually, I think it's just the other way around.
It's the other way around, okay.
Yesterday, Jamie Dimon over at JPMorgan Chase, his annual letter, he likened AI to the steam engine. Do you believe we're at an inflection point that is indeed that drastic?
I think it is. When you talk to our customers, the sheer amount of ideas that are both driven from top of house from the CEOs that are saying, look, generative AI is a priority for us, right? We need to think about how this changes our business. But also sort of from the rank and file, anyone who's ever gone to a GPT bot and actually asked it questions sort of suddenly understands how efficient they can drive their own business. It was travelers who kind of in their own use of generative AI so saved $100 million from an operational expense perspective just by automating those tasks that tend to be very document, labor, human intensive to kind of be able to be more efficient. You know, we're talking at the Smarsh conference today, from a compliance perspective, we've seen firms like Nasdaq's Verafin, who does anti-money laundering, you know, be able to reduce, you know, the time it takes to investigate a fraud alert by like 60%. And when you think about
that's
those
huge
operational savings at scale, you're seeing sort of just huge excitement about the potential for adoption. And then I think we see it really being embedded in almost every application. So no matter what you use, it's almost going to have that kind of capability embedded.
Is that what's kind of surprising? Because we do, you know, John, we talk about that AI is not anything new. It's been around. It's just now we're talking about kind of next level, right? Mm-hmm. When we talk about machine learning and generative AI. But I think about our audience who are listening, like what would surprise them about what you are seeing when it comes to generative AI and the usage? It's not just about what it maybe can do. It's what it's already doing, it feels like, in many ways.
Part of it is that the pace of change over the last year has been so dramatic in just what the models are capable of.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we saw just sort of, we work part closely with Anthropic, kind of made an equity investment in them. And just sort of seeing the difference between sort of Claude 2 and Claude 3 in both its performance, but also its cost. And that's over less than a year period. And what you're seeing is that there's such a variety of models and the models are getting so much better that it's not just that you're seeing immediate benefits in production with some of these productivity applications, is that you're all thinking, oh, gosh, if this keeps going, this is going to change the way I look at almost everything. And, you know, generally I don't focus as much, but we're seeing that on the developer productivity side.
Right.
If you're a programmer and you're looking to write code or update code, the tools are getting so powerful, and you're just seeing these massive efficiencies and being able to kind of innovate from a product side. It's hard to know where it stops, and I think that's why everyone's so excited.
I should note the investment in Anthropic is a huge investment, an additional $2.75 billion just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. Well, and then the second tranche.
Exactly.
And as part of that, not only do our customers get the benefit of being able to use the Anthropic model, Anthropic's committed to sort of integrating with our platform to get better price and performance for our customers.
Yeah, so interesting, the integration of it. John, thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
This was great. John Kane, Head of Financial Services Market Development over at AWS, joining us here at Smarsh Connect.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Hurd, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
A little bit of sound in the background. We are here at Smarsh Connect in Midtown Manhattan. We've stepped outside Bloomberg headquarters. They're going to bring down the volume a little bit, but it's exciting.
Because people are partying.
Well, it is. People are partying. It's a moment where they bring in clients and customers, and they're talking things like technology. They're talking AI. They're talking compliance. And so there's a lot of good energy.
Well, speaking of AI, Carol, Intel rolling out a new version of its artificial intelligence chip, aiming to challenge NVIDIA in one of the fastest growing parts of the semiconductor industry.
Right. Out with an updated processor. It will be widely available in the third quarter. It's designed to boost performance in two key areas, helping train AI systems and also a process that involves bombarding them with data. We know that. And also running the finished software. It's all about AI. We know that. We've been talking about it nonstop for over a year now. And someone who knows a lot about it is Brandon Carl. He's Executive Vice President of AI and Product Strategy at Smarsh, with us on site here at Smarsh Connect. So good to have you here with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for inviting us, actually. We're here in your home. AI, there's so much going on every day. AI is not new. We know that. We say that all the time. But next level, machine learning, generative AI, and what it can do. How do you get your head around what really matters? It's something we ask our AI reporters. What matters? What doesn't? How do you figure that out?
One of my favorite quotes in this space is AI is always what the computer can't do now, right? And what it could do yesterday. And so when you take a look at this, what we take a look at is what is the outcome the customer is trying to achieve. And when we look at things like AI and machine learning, there are about a dozen different technologies we use in terms of taking customers into production and their software. So when we use these and when we see things like generative AI, there are incredible new things that this technology can do. Mm-hmm. And that enables us to do incredible new things for our customers.
I think back to when AI got on a lot of people's radar. Not people in the space, but like investors who really started to think about it as a new category for them, or lay people really. It's this idea of like kind of playing with ChatGPT for the first time, perhaps in the fall of 2022. When did it get on your radar?
A long time ago. So we have been...
How long?
We started work on natural language processing back in 2000. It was a company Smarsh acquired called Digital Reasoning. And then we started working with the financial services industry in 2015 and 2016. And we started doing very large-scale deployments then. So we've been working for a long time.
Why was there such a long period of time between 2000 and 2015, 2016, when you started actually implementing it?
Sure. The early customers were actually government customers that were interested in national defense and security. And it wasn't until after the LIBOR crisis, you had about 3 to 5 years where budgets increased and suddenly people said, there's got to be a better way to keep the markets safe.
How does crisis and lawsuits and fines and things like that kind of shape what you guys are doing, and you particularly?
Sure. I would like to think that the industry could be wildly proactive, but typically what happens is some event happens, right? And then firms get budgets and they say, we need to prevent that from happening again. So there really is a cause and effect that plays out there.
Is it getting a lot more complicated, though?
It is, mostly because the number of ways people communicate has expanded.
It's something we've been talking about. Yeah. I mean, he's been working for years on
it. Hard.
All the issues with WhatsApp, for example, just one platform. How do you deal with that?
To process more than 100 different platforms. And if you think about this, even 5 years, 300 million today. So whether it's Slack, Teams, Zoom, WhatsApp, WeChat, Line, Signal, like there are all different ways people communicate.
I was in doing research for this interview, I was trying to find information about how many messages a bank typically processes in a single day.
Yep.
Couldn't find that data anywhere.
Yep.
Give us some numbers.
Yeah,
it really depends on the firm and the type of firm. A typical employee is like anywhere from 1 to 500 messages a day.
Each employee, 1 to 500. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, so give us some huge numbers here about the processing that you're doing in real time.
Yeah. So firms can generate as many as tens of millions of messages every single day, right? And we will process billions and billions of communications. So if you imagine all of the comms coming together, that's what we really have to process.
If everyone's here today, who's processing the communications?
Yeah, I'm worried about that myself. Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at the notes that your team shared with us and regulatory grade AI.
Yep.
What exactly does that mean? Because I do feel like it's going to be a term that we're going to be using increasingly.
Yeah, absolutely. So on one hand, people can log into ChatGPT and just use it, right?
Yeah.
But when you think about a regulated industry, you have to protect against things like bias. You need to make sure that you understand how things are actually working.
Yeah.
You need to make sure that you can rely on that over and over again. So it's really a higher standard in terms of how you approach things.
I want to ask you, because you do have probably, you guys in particular, have a great, we tried to ask Steve, like, who are your clients? But he's really quiet. But we know you guys are well entrenched, certainly within the financial sector. But I do wonder, Brandon, when you look at things, I mean, how equipped is the financial community when it comes to compliance and risk and transparency? In a world where increasingly, as we said, there are more and more touch points that create risk, and in a world where there are more and more oversight and regulators looking for problems.
It's a hard problem to tackle, particularly for firms that have global regulation on things.
Yeah.
What I can say, we genuinely have fantastic customers within this space, and what you typically see is you see a handful of them really trying to trailblaze and lead the industry forward to make markets safer and to make their firm safer, and they help to trailblaze to create the paths for the rest of the firms to follow
and bring along like their supply chain with them.
To some extent their supply chain, but typically less so in what we do.
Okay.
You know, I hear you and Steve speaking, and I think about another highly regulated industry, medicine, and also an industry that is trying to figure out how to use AI. Any talk, discussion about getting into medicine? It has the HIPAA stuff when it comes to communications between patients and doctors. It has the regulatory issues as well. Is that at all? Does that all come up on your radar?
It does come up on our radar. We really look at regulated industries as areas that we can have the biggest impact. So pharma is one of those, energy is another, and then financial services. So we do think we can have some impact, but we're really squarely focused on solving these markets use cases as best we can in the near term.
So again, like I keep thinking about the Bloomberg audience. So what are you guys, I'm sure there are scenarios you play out. Okay, these are the risk scenarios that we need to be thinking about in a world increasingly that is ruled by machine learning, generative AI. What are the risks that you think that we should all be kind of preparing for? Because we're not going to catch everything.
Yeah, we won't.
Unfortunately.
We won't catch everything. And typically what you'll see, sometimes you'll see nefarious bad actors within firms.
Right.
And then other times there are people who just don't know any better. And you really want to help the people who don't know better to say, hey, you didn't intend to do this. Like, this is the right way to do things. But we also have to keep an eye towards the people who are ruining the reputations of their firms or, you know, other people who are trying to do the right thing.
So really bad actors.
There are bad actors, unfortunately, that are out there.
Huh. Are those usually internal within a firm in trying to have some sort of inside edge when it comes to making money? Or are they usually bad actors from the outside?
It can be both, right? Typically, the outside bad actors are more from an information security standpoint, right? And sometimes there are people internally who are just trying to make a buck and not do the right thing.
AI, the conversation in a year from now, just got about 30 seconds left here.
Sure.
Do you think it'll be dramatically different or just more of the same?
It will keep improving, absolutely. And we need to keep figuring out how we can actually use these technologies in the right way to improve the world.
All right. Really interesting stuff. I don't envy you because you've got a lot coming at you. Brandon Carl, Executive Vice President of AI and Product Strategy at Smarsh, joining us here on site at Smarsh Connect.
Really, really cool stuff.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
Last week, the SEC won a jury verdict in its groundbreaking insider trading case that seeks to bar employees from using non-public information about their own company to place bets on rival stock. Also, a former Flow executive and his cousin recently admitted to insider trading on confidential information about a pandemic-related government loan to Eastman Kodak. All of this happening, Carol, while the agency has been dealing with a number of high-profile crypto cases. And I got to tell you,
we could go on and on.
This is just a sampling of what I found when I typed into the Bloomberg terminal, NI fraud.
anti fraud. Yeah, there's a lot. So I'm guessing it's not going to come as a surprise.
Fraud and alleged fraud.
to be fair. We're guessing this won't come as a surprise to our next guest. Rob Maher is with us. He's a principal in EY's consulting practice. He spent decades working on risk and regulatory compliance, tech, and operations. Think sanctions, anti-money laundering, fraud management, and of course, working with regulators. It feels like it's all the courses that we take at Bloomberg to make sure that we are compliant and very careful. Welcome. Nice to be talking with you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell us about your world.
Any stock tips? I'm just kidding.
We are public. I mean, we're all like, we've got a public platform.
Stock tips, a bit of a problem. So basically, the way I kind of put my job overall is, you know, I help financial institutions get out of trouble and stay out of trouble. If you just see all the different things happening in the news, you know, you mentioned insider trading just a second ago. You know, there's all sorts of different types of regulatory compliance matters that hit institutions from any number of areas. And they're very complex, you know, particularly when you start dealing with a large multinational firm.
Right.
The regulations may be different. In some cases, they may be conflicting between different jurisdictions. And trying to navigate that to figure out how you can do something and do the right thing is a bit of a challenge.
Is it, though? Because, okay, I got to tell you, when I was going through all
these. I love when Tim does that. Is it, though?
All these fraud and alleged fraud. I mean, it seems like a lot of this stuff is pretty clear cut, and you get people, the stuff that I'm reading about, mind you, is pretty clear cut. Like, okay, yes, this is okay. No, this is not okay type of stuff. And it seems like it's not necessarily the firms. It's certain individuals within firms that are just looking to make more money.
It can be a combination of both. And while some of the things are very, very, you know, black and white, you know, if you look at, you know, like front-running somebody's trade. Very, very straightforward in terms of how that's done. But if you start to think about how that actually works out, you know, front-running, you understand the concept. Mm-hmm. But think about you have, you know, thousands, if not, you know, hundreds of thousands, or even in some cases millions of trades going through a day, and all the particulars around those trades. So let's take a very simple example. Suppose that you place a trade on behalf of your customer, and or you place it on behalf of a bunch of customers, and then you reallocate it afterwards. Well, the way that it might show up in terms of how it looks in the data is it actually looks like front running because you traded before the customer mm-hmm. order went through, but you were trading on behalf of a customer. Does that count as front running? No, obviously it doesn't. And then there's certain exemptions. There's a black box exemption. There's all sorts of these different variations. Now, it doesn't mean that there aren't some things that are just straight white. You know, you mentioned some of the insider trading questions. You know, but there are other things where it becomes more of a risk question. You know, if you look at money laundering activity, other mm-hmm. types of things like that, where it's like, well, you know, how much do you know versus how much should you have known versus how much was hidden from you, you know, versus, you know, what are your employees doing? It becomes a bit of a challenge. Again, doesn't mean there's not some black and white stuff. There's definitely some black and white stuff. But unfortunately, there's a decent amount of grayness.
But in a world that is increasingly digital, if not all digital, I think about even as a journalist, go back how many mm-hmm. years, and I didn't spend as much time on a computer. Now I live on a computer, no matter what I'm doing. My whole life right now is on a computer. Does it make it easier in terms of tracking down compliance and risk and or figuring out, okay, did something really wrong happen here? Or does it make it easier or more complicated?
It's another little bit of both. Because one thing that kind of comes into play is just the sheer volume of data. I work with a number of customers, and if you just think about it, just the data that's coming, think ATM footage, just the videos coming out of that. That can be literally petabytes of data.
Wow, yeah.
You know, if you look at the number of emails going through, or you take a large U.S. financial institution, one of the top four, 1 billion transactions per day. Hmm. You know, not counting the trades, not counting all the other things that are happening, all the other events.
Just the consumer-facing stuff. Just
so what do you do with something like that? How do you scrape through or figure out what, I mean, do you have to, is everything gone over? Like, how do you deal with that?
So you definitely rely on a lot of automated and analytics type of activity, but you're constantly tuning and adjusting it. You know, like I do a lot of work in the fraud space as an example.
Right.
Every time you swipe your credit card, there are literally, you know, hundreds of algorithms running in the background to try and figure out whether or not this is actually you. Does it make sense? Is it something that, you know, we should block or we should allow? And they have to make that decision in milliseconds because otherwise, you know, you're getting a rejection.
Right.
And you want to minimize that. And that behavior is going to continue to evolve. And so you're constantly bringing in new data. You're tweaking your algorithms. You're adjusting these things. And then multiply this by the, you know, literally thousands of compliance regulations you need to check too. You have to rely on the automation. And then, you know, people are getting very, very, very advanced in, you know, you've seen deep fakes. You know, how can you tell the difference between a deep fake activity and non-deep fake activity?
Let's talk about that a little bit. How can you?
So if you're an ethical company who's built the technology to do this, and they talked a little bit about during the conference today, you can tag images, you can tag different types of things as being, you know, generated by AI. If you're not an ethical company, or you're a fraudster, or you're, you know, some type of scammer, you are going to not put those tags in, and you're going to do your best to adjust them. It doesn't mean that you can't detect them in different ways.
I don't know, how many times a day do you get text messages from somebody who's trying to who's literally trying to take money from you?
Literally, one of my favorite questions I ask people. When, you know, the other one being that everybody's information is compromised, and you just kind of have to accept it and protect against it. But yes, you get. I got one. Couple weeks ago, from the electric company, telling me if I didn't pay in 45 minutes, they were going to shut off my power.
Right.
You know, and because I work in the business, I'm like, yeah, this is.
I guess
real.
What I'm saying is, there's no shortage of bad actors.
No.
Like, you know, there's no chance that the bad actors are going to tag their Gen AI with any sort of metadata that will show that it was generated by AI.
No, but there are ways and analytics techniques that can be used to detect different types of activities.
But the problem is that it's the best line of defense is a person, right? Oftentimes, and people don't have that type of training.
No, they don't. I mean, I've told any number of people, you know, pretty much don't click on any link in any email, don't click on any pop-up ad, don't, you know.
Right.
But, you know, the fraudsters are getting sophisticated. In fact, a current trend is now that the old-style fraudsters are no longer committing fraud. They're just creating toolkits, personas, you know, mule accounts, other types of things, and selling to fraudsters actually commit the actual fraud now. So,
picks and shovels, that's where the money is.
Are we more secure than we used to be? Or are we more vulnerable because there are a lot of tools out there to enable people to trick us?
I think it's a constant battle. I think in many ways, you know, despite, you know, my earlier statement that everybody's information is compromised to some extent. I mean, pretty much, you know, your social security number's out there, address, name, all that type of stuff's out there. But how, you know, and there's definitely identity theft happening, and it's on the rise, and it continues to occur. But is it a daily occurrence for most individuals? No. You know, is it reasonable to say that at some point in your life, you know, probably within the next 5 to 10 years at most, you know, everybody will have some type of identity compromise of some sort? Yeah, I think that's a legitimate thing.
But what does that mean? Is that just the case of, we tapped into your health insurer, got your, that? Are you talking on that level or something more serious when you say that?
It could be more serious. It could be that they opened up a credit card in your name, you know, and then the first thing you notice is when it shows up on your credit report, which hopefully you check regularly, and then you see that, and then you can deal with it and get rid of it. It could be that, you know, somebody, like there's been cases lately with houses where people are selling houses that they don't own, you know, and are you actually able to, you know, rely on people to find this stuff for you? And who do you rely on? I think that the tools are out there to make it better overall. And in one sense, you are more secure, but you're constantly fighting a battle.
Wasn't this the promise of the blockchain? And it's kind of a perfect segue to talking to you about crypto a little bit and how your life has become more complicated as a result of crypto. But wasn't this the promise of the blockchain, that we'd all have our own identifying information with us at all times? Our house was our house because it said so on a ledger.
It could be to a certain extent if it is out, you know, if it's already, everything was already on the blockchain, but it's not. One of the challenges I think overall with the blockchain is that, you know, bad data as well as good data becomes permanent. That becomes a bit of a challenge when you start dealing with, you know, some of these things along the way. You know, blockchain is not everywhere at the moment. So like you mentioned, owning a house, that's not on a blockchain right now. There's a fairly good chance it's in some, you know, local county clerk's registrar.
Doesn't or sound like you think it will be either in the near future.
Not in the near future. I think aspects of it definitely. I mean, there's a lot of activity in, you know, decentralized finance. You mentioned cryptocurrency. You know, there are some definite areas where I think that it already exists and it will continue to grow in some of those areas. But is it something that is going to happen in the next, you know, year, 2, 5 years, 10 years? I don't think quite so much.
I mean, I hate to play like Armageddon and like, you know, the dark day, but I mean, is there a moment in time that you would anticipate, just because things are getting so much more sophisticated and the tools are out there and everybody who's doing compliance is certainly trying to keep up on it, but there's going to be a point where you go to access
your bank and you can't, or you go to look at your investments and they're wiped. Like, is that the scale? And again, I'm not trying to be inflammatory, but I'm just trying to be realistic.
I don't think that it's going to get quite to that, because if nothing else, the financial institutions have some pretty strong controls in place for things like that. And they also, many of them will, reimburse you for different types of activities that happen
right
along the way. And I mean, if you went into your brokerage account, all your investments are gone, they are going to be taking a look at that to figure out what happens. But most likely, when they saw somebody trying to sell out of your entire portfolio and transfer the money, it would have raised 27 red flags along the way, and they would have blocked it a little bit
earlier. That's why when you're traveling and the credit card company calls and says, is this you? Because are you really there?
Good stuff.
But it puts it on you.
But it puts it on you.
It does put it on you, because if you didn't answer the text, well, then they're going to block it. And then that means that your credit card might be locked in a particular country because you didn't see your text. And so
there's an awareness on all levels, right?
Yeah. And it's not like every asset is protected at the same level. Like, somebody selling your house. I mean, that's protected at one level. Somebody, if your credit cards are protected differently from your debit cards, which are protected differently from your brokerage account, there are different rules in place for all of those. And it means that you can't be oblivious. You have to be somewhat vigilant. You have to check your credit report. You have to make sure that, if you do get a text from your bank, first of all, make sure it actually is from your bank.
There's plenty of stuff there to keep you busy. And
Carol,
your
team busy. add check your credit report to the to-do list, okay?
I do, actually.
Okay, good. All right, that's what I like to hear. Rob Mara is a principal in EY's consulting practice, joining us here at Smarsh Connect.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We just had kind of a sobering conversation with all the risks associated with AI, with data,
I was still telling us stories about fraud and just romance fraud, pig butchering, which we've done stories. Yeah. Our team has done reporting on that. Like, it's just every day there's tons of stuff going on.
Needless to say, I think it keeps a lot of folks up at night who are thinking about risk and risk management. And that's exactly what our next guest focuses on, providing compliance and risk technology for 19 of the world's 20 largest banks, in addition to serving other customers of Smarsh. Tom Padgett is president of enterprise business at Smarsh. He's here on site with us at Smarsh Connect. Tom, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having us here. Thanks for joining us. Tim, Carol,
thanks
great to meet you. Yeah.
How would you describe what you do here?
Great question. What I do personally.
What you do personally,
I run. So we have really two segments of our business. We have small, medium business, think registered independent agents, small shops, 10 to 100 people. And then we service the largest financial institutions in the world. And what you find, while we deliver similar sets of capabilities, very, very different needs. So when you're talking to the largest financial institutions globally, they're worried about things that maybe are a little bit different than some of the smaller companies, still regulated, but looking for a lot of complexity that maybe isn't inherent in a smaller organization.
I always think of that conversation that Jamie Dimon did, I don't know, is it now 10 years ago, 15 years ago, up on stage, and he said, they were like, what's the thing that keeps him up at night? What's the number one thing? And he was talking about cybersecurity concerns.
Yeah, you bet.
And the technology spend, and that he was focusing on it. And I think about, okay, here we are over a decade or so later, and I can just think top of mind.
Absolutely.
What the executives say that they need to be thinking about.
It's a huge board-level topic.
Yeah.
Right? What are the risks we're exposed to? Obviously, 2008 had a huge impact on this space. So the ability to, and what's really exciting now too, is we've gone from a world where we've gotten all this information, petabytes and petabytes of information,
right,
all the communications with customers, and it's been really more of a, okay, what can we personally find out there that might be there, and utilizing AI to do that. I know, buzzword AI, right? But now it's turned into a world with generative AI. Okay, what can the machines tell us that maybe we never thought? How can we take this information, which is hugely critical to protect our institutions, but also make us better at what we do?
Why will generative AI, machine learning, kind of make us be better when it comes to risk and compliance?
Yeah, so it helps. So think of it this way. And it can get, I'm even like, what the heck? So we've been using AI, all of us have been using AI for a long time.
And we keep saying that too as a caveat. It's not a new thing.
Yeah, it's not a new thing.
But what it can do, its capabilities.
Yeah, so think, part of what we're doing now is generative. We're bringing things. So it's that difference between, okay, I'm going to tell it what to look for and what to ask, and then it comes back and gives me something based on loads and loads of information. Generative is the machine's really thinking and thinking things that, Carol, you didn't think of. Tim, you didn't think of. I didn't think of, and wow, I never thought of that. And wow, that could now protect me in a way that I never knew I even needed to look at. Mm-hmm. It's really, really exciting.
I understand this from product development perspective. I understand it from a drug development perspective. Yeah. Carol and I have talked to our colleagues at Bloomberg who've reported extensively on those. But when you think of financial services,
yeah,
what can it provide that we don't know is out there?
There's so much. So first and foremost, let's think better service, right? So think about what we deal with for your listeners are communications intelligence. So all communications data that a financial institution might have with their customer has to be stored, archived.
Right.
Okay. So the ability to go in and say, how many things do you see out there? We're like, well, what do our customers really want? What do they need? Well, you now know and can see and understand and hear firsthand what it is they're looking for. And it's so buried in mass volumes of data. It's beyond looking for a needle in a haystack and a haystack and a haystack. It's even more. Well, now the machines can go through and figure that out and provide a better level of service. Or potentially protect the organization.
How do you make sure, though, that the machines that are going in and either providing or going to provide better service or better, you know, catching, you know, problems where there's kind of risks, if you will. How do you make sure that they're going to do the right thing? Because it's only as good as the information that goes into it.
Bingo. And you just hit on the magic question, which is, okay, do we just turn these loose and away we go? The answer to that is no. So you need to make sure that the large LLM, large language models that are being used, that there's some level of oversight on those and what is included there. So the machine can go off in a way that you never intended it to.
Right.
So there also needs, so they call it drift, machine drift. It starts to drift off. There needs to continue to be, this is why it's a bit of a fallacy. You'll hear, all jobs will be gone. That's not true. Jobs will change. They'll be different. But you'll need people to look and say, hey, this model's starting to drift in a way we never wanted it to or meant it to. Hey, let's rein this back in.
Right.
What jobs do you think are at risk?
What I would say is anything that is and I don't think it's risk isn't necessarily the right word, but hey, what are ones that the machines do really think repetitive in nature?
Yeah.
So let me give you an example. So one of the areas on AI right now, some organizations had historically used was, okay, I just got, at one point in time, we would get
it's this Martian.
We just saw a Smartian walking
just
by.
Went which, by. Aliens have landed, everybody.
It's very cute.
1,000 notifications of things that might potentially be risky communications. All right? So you may have a team of people that go through that in a email. Let's use email. Email by email. What did Carol really mean here? When she was talking about her children at home, she really meant her children at home.
I asked that question a lot ago.
I'm sure you do. Yeah.
So
there's a machine that can help me?
That's a level of, and very rarely do people, I love doing that. And now think about it this way.
Yeah.
What used to be thousands of identified now is millions. Well, what had been a solution is, okay, we just need to get a lot of people to look at that.
So what do they call it? Tech adjacent or human, like, right? That basically technology adjacent with human or like working together
hand
by side. Forgive me if I'm mangling the term.
Yeah, but very much so.
You know, I'm listening to you speak, and I know the financial community is kind of your bread and butter, and that's your guys' focus. But I'm thinking about the world of social media in general and the problems that are there. That why can't you, it sounds like, from your knowledge and expertise, to create something that can also go in and scrape the things that are incorrect, false, wrong, dangerous.
Yeah.
Is it that potentially easy?
The technology's there.
Yeah.
So from our perspective, we do. So it's one of the communications that we
monitor.
It's what
you guys have to do, right, to protect
we
those
do.
Financial
Absolutely.
Funds.
So our customers have to make sure that Tim works for our institution and you have a Twitter account. We have to make sure that is something that we can capture, that we make sure that nothing's going out in a way for that financial institution. We absolutely do that.
But I mean bigger broadly in terms of social media. You know that I'm not necessarily trying to put you on the spot, but this idea of social media and all of the bad information that's out there, and it doesn't seem like we can get a grasp on it, but it sounds like
technologically
ability.
Now then you get into other, like, hey, what do we want to do? I won't get into that, but hey, what do we want to be able to look at? What do we want to limit?
Yeah.
But the technology, and keep in mind too, we don't say not what you can't do,
yeah,
but we will identify, hey, this communication that went out is not in compliance with your standards. That is something that we absolutely do, and financial institutions are all over that.
Give us an idea of how often that happens.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, it's crazy. And oftentimes, here the biggest challenge that financial institutions have are false positives.
Yeah.
So let's
happens a lot?
Yeah, sure, because what can happen is the bad folks are really, really creative. So, you know, I'll use an example. I always tell my wife, she's like, what do you do? Nobody's going to say, hey, I think I'm going to do an insider trade. I'm feeling like this is something I need to do. No, there's going to be, they'll go from what we say, cross channel. Hmm. Hey, let's take this offline.
Yeah.
Those are the types of things. So the machine can go in and identify intent even and say, wait, hey, you probably need to
That's
look
nuanced.
At this one.
Yeah. Meaning asking somebody to take it
offline.
To a different form of communication.
Tim said, go pick up my children from school.
Yeah.
Tim really meant go pick up my children from school. Or Tim said, go pick up my children from school, and somebody else said, well, the children at school waiting for you to pull. All of a sudden, the machine can pick that. And again, one of the challenges is now the volumes of data are so massive, which really a lot of that came from COVID, where I used to be able to dictate and mandate to you, Tim, you can't use plug-in tool name.
Well, okay, so are you capturing you capture communications on the phone?
Over 100 different channels of communication.
But including voice
is something that's a little more difficult.
Yeah.
It's something that we are working on a lot, but you get in transcription. The crazy part about voice that gets into is, and it's funny, we have this conversation constantly. Spanish is not Spanish is not Spanish is not Spanish.
Yeah.
Right.
English is not English. So you have to, and the machines are still not great at that.
Huh.
But from a technical perspective, it is absolutely something we look at.
So phone's part of it, voice part of it, and Zoom, Teams, all that stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah.
So all those, and use those examples. Pre-COVID, I as a financial institution could mandate you can't use this. You can't use this tool to talk to your customers. All of a sudden, you have to use
right.
it to talk to your customers.
Right.
So there's been such an explosion of data. You know, it's funny, I joke sometimes with our customers. I say, we adopted this crazy concept back in 2017. I think you talked to Steve earlier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Called the cloud.
Yeah.
Well, and truly at that time, people thought we were nuts. People said, nobody will ever put their compliance data in the cloud. It will not happen. Now, it's the only way to scale. So COVID hits. Now we have these on-prem. I'm using these terms, but on-prem.
Yeah, we talked about on-premise.
Yeah,
you know,
so
enterprise systems and so on and so forth.
All of a sudden, I'm an internal financial institution. I have an on-prem system and massive volumes of data. The hardware cost alone to keep up with that. Versus if you partner with a partner like us, we partner with AWS, for instance, they can scale like that globally.
But what about speed and reliability? Like, some might say, hey, listen,
critical.
I want to have it closer, so maybe I'm going to have a hybrid and I'm going to play around cloud and, you know, a little bit of combination.
Yeah, it's
I don't know if that's affecting you guys at all.
It does, and it's a conversation. A lot of what we do is...
Or do you say, don't do it?
No. So what we say and we show, and a lot of what we do is proof. It's actually a lot of the assumptions are not valid. So speed and reliability and safety is actually higher in the cloud. So these are institutions that you know, these big hyperscalers, this is what they do. And they're used to handling those massive volumes.
So can I just...
Oh, go ahead.
Well, I know we have to wrap. 30 seconds. So I'm thinking about Bloomberg investment community and thinking about, okay, I'm listening, you know, to Tom talk here. So what does that mean? Do you think, you know, cloud is just, it's just going to grow even more exponential? Like, what's the investment thought or thesis off of what you are seeing?
Cloud is here to stay. That's not going anywhere. And in fact, oftentimes you get to a point where it's like, well, of course, that's how you're going to scale it. They're organizations and companies. This is, again, what they do. And when I say what they do, not just scale, but they're used to those bad actors that are trying to get. They deal with that all the time. So, again, not to get into too much technology, but we are what we call a triple active architecture. So think, at any given time, your data is in three potential areas. So if all of a sudden there's an event that happens here, shuts it down, you run with it. You never even knew.
Because of the other.
Okay, we got to run, but next, you have 19 of the 20 largest banks. When we talk to you in a year, you're going to have 20 of 20?
Yep. Okay. Pretty sure.
Okay. Want to share their names?
There it is.
I got close a couple times. So.
Tom Padgett, thank you so
much.
Thank
you.
Really fun. Tom Padgett, he's president, enterprise business here at Smarsh.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.